Do you have zerts and or veg?
Well, I mean, my zerts from earlier this week are that I'm officially incorporated as a limited liability corporation.
You are now a person.
Now I can say for real that I'm a person. Yes. Yeah. Kid Stuff Hospitality. Holler at me for all your hospitality needs.
All your underage drinking needs. Kid Stuff Hospitality. We're that guy standing outside the liquor store 24/7.
Fuck you, buddy.
Jamie's but also, just waiting for a bunch of high school kids to come up and be like, hey, sir, can you go get us a case of beer?
Absolutely, Jimmy.
And then Jamie just starts fucking going off about milk stouts and tries to convince them to get Pinot Grigio instead.
This is a weird alternate reality that you're constructing. I don't even know.
I don't know if that's a good business model, but that is a business model.
It's a bad business model. Yeah. First of all, it's illegal.
Well, you've done plenty of illegal things before.
Yeah, but not like for profit.
That's what makes it okay. Not for profit.
Recreational illegal things,
right,
I've done.
Right. Can I tell you something nice?
Yes, please.
Friend of the show, T-Jam, reached out to me last night.
We love T-Jam.
T-Jam.
He's a good boy.
And said, in fact, I'll just read it to you because it's good and I want to make sure I capture T-Jam's words accurately. You and Jamie have moved me with your words. I'll be giving Hulk another watch.
Oh.
So, after listening to our top five flavors of Marvel episode, T-Jam, who swore off the Ang Lee Hulk movie, he's a purist. He likes his traditional representations of his and our super characters on the big screen.
He sure does.
He's given it another shot.
That gives me the warm fuzzies.
18 years later, T-Jam is coming back around and he wants to watch it. And I told him once the children are in, you know, the properly vaccinated zone, T-Jam is welcome to come over here and we will watch it together.
I would be happy to be in on that screening.
All right, well, let's make it happen because I just bought the 4K. The Blu-ray looks bad, all right? There's like a long stretch of Universal Studios Blu-ray releases that look bad.
Can we not?
Bad.
We don't have to do this.
They look bad.
Every time.
Apparently the 4K is breathtaking on this movie.
Good.
I'm very excited.
I'm excited to watch it with you.
All right, anyway.
Am I ready to intro the show?
I think we should start
the
show.
Can I intro the goddamn show?
Are you ready to intro the show?
I'm ready. Are you ready?
No. Let's begin.
Welcome, everybody.
Welcome
to You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about movies and wine.
Happy New Year, Jamie. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year.
Yeah. All right.
This is a future episode.
Yeah.
We're recording this in November.
Yeah. This is like a week before Thanksgiving, and this episode will drop on December 31st.
Huh.
So Happy New Year, everybody.
Damn New Year, everyone. I hope you're already drunk.
I mean, Jamie certainly is. It's 6 weeks away and he's already drunk.
I am already drunk. That's correct.
But yeah, enjoy your New Year's celebrations. Make sure they're safe and, you know, also safe. Safe in the ways that New Year's should always be treated safely. And then also, yeah.
Also the extra layer of safety. Anyway.
It's a show.
It's a podcast about movies and wine.
Movies and wine.
Movies and wine. For those of you who don't know anything about one or both of those topics, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
His name is Jamie. He is the wine guy. My name is Scott. I am the movie guy. And we are here to help you. Each episode, we pair a movie that I love with a wine that he loves.
We will tell you why we like them, how they're made, and why they work. Hopefully, we find a pairing that works. Sometimes we don't. Today, we continue with our lighthearted, no bummers, all sunshine miniseries. It's the end of the world as we know it. And I want wine.
Oh, God. All right. So today we are talking about The Matrix.
It rules.
So not a lot of people listening have probably seen this movie. This is a pretty obscure, independent, you know, under the radar, off the beaten path release.
I'm having trouble breathing in here, Scott. It's getting very sarcastic.
Yeah, I know. Fuck you. What am I even supposed to say? What do I need to say? It's The Matrix. It came out in 1999. It was written and directed by Lana and Lily Wachowski. It is only their second feature, which is insane to me. It was a huge hit. It changed pop culture. It spawned two sequels, which people don't really like as much, but are actually mostly kind of great. There's a new sequel coming. I'm very excited for it. There's literally nothing else I can say that wouldn't just be a waste of people's time. It's The Matrix. It's so insanely popular and ubiquitous and beloved, and it's the fucking Matrix. And we're talking about it.
It's The Matrix.
It's The Matrix.
Yeah.
We're talking about The Matrix.
Yeah, even if you haven't seen The Matrix, which is baffling at this point,
right?
You definitely have like some of the cultural touchstones.
Can you imagine being like an adult person today and never having seen The Matrix before?
I cannot.
I mean, they're out there. Those people are out
there. They exist, for sure. Although I bet you there's one person listening to this right now that has not and is like pumping their fist in the air angrily.
Yeah. Oh, speaking of which, for that one person 6 weeks from now, spoilers. Spoilers for The Matrix and probably for several other things. There, you've been warned.
Yes.
I don't have an organized take. I don't have an organized discussion for this movie. It's just The Matrix. Let's start with Jamie.
We basically have the same thoughts on this movie, which is that it fucking rules. I mean, both of us were 14 when it came out.
Did we? So I grilled you recently about not remembering shared theatrical experiences.
Yes,
correctly.
And now you're having trouble with this one.
I believe we saw this together.
I am not certain of that. I don't have a specific memory, I'll say.
I don't have a super specific memory. I remember I saw it with my mom and with at least one other person. I think it was you, but it might have been Hafe.
There's
friend
something
of the show, Hafe Hafington.
I have trouble remembering a time without it, to be honest. And partly, like, I was 14 when I saw it. And that's an age where, like, you solidify your worldview and the things that you know about the world.
Your tastes are cementing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the idea of a world without The Matrix is, like, it basically doesn't exist for me.
It is wild that the movie is 22 years old and it feels much more, like, recent and relevant. Like, it really hasn't aged at all.
No, it hasn't.
The only thing, like, the rotary, like the cell phones, but then the big chunky Nokia cell phones, which really just feels anachronistic. And even canonically in the world of the story, like, it's all anachronism because the machines recreated a city at the peak of humanity.
That's why it doesn't even feel out of time.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. it all, like, that movie could have come out yesterday.
Yeah, they
and
just
it would have just as much impact.
They happened to choose 1999 as the setting for The Matrix,
right?
Like, inside the computer, and it could have come out at any moment.
It's so much fun. What was your viewing experience with it? You watched it recently on the HBO Max.
So I actually did a full rewatch of all of the trilogy.
You did the trilogy. Normally, I'm not down with the T word in reference to a lot of movie series because I find it to just be branding. But, like, that's just straight up a trilogy. That's okay. It's a trilogy.
Right.
Some things are not trilogies.
What is not a trilogy?
All right. So I would say the Indiana Jones movies are not a trilogy. And not just because there's now four of them, soon to be five of them.
Could there not be five of them?
Well, but could
that not be a thing?
But Jamie, I know you don't want to see a 75-year-old Indiana Jones running around.
I don't.
But all those plane crashes that man keeps doing, like, those lawyer bills have got to be going up, you know? Harrison Ford could use another $25 million is all I'm saying.
Yeah.
Anyway, where were we?
It's a trilogy. Yes, I agree with you that in a cohesive way, Indiana Jones is not a trilogy.
Right. They're just three movies that happen to feature the same character.
Right. But The Matrix is a trilogy. Anyway, I rewatched the trilogy before you had given me the list for this current miniseries. I forgot exactly where I got it into my head that I wanted to do the rewatch. It was probably around the time that the Resurrections trailer. Yeah. And I was just so excited for each movie too. Like, obviously the first Matrix is far and above the other two.
I mean, it's basically perfect.
But even the other two were so exciting to watch. Except
when they're not.
There are moments when they're not, but it's largely carried through on a wave of excitement that kind of gets you there.
Yeah. This is not the Unpacking the Matrix Sequels podcast, although I don't know, we could eventually talk about them.
Yeah.
Because I will defend a lot of things about them.
A future palate cleanser.
Yeah. I'll take an ambitious and personal and idiosyncratic not successful sequel over, you know, something that's packaged and corporate and homogenized.
For
and
sure.
Easier,
I think both of us respond to ambition in that way. When something is exciting, when you can see that they're swinging for the fences.
Yeah.
But specifically with this movie, you know, it had been years since I watched it and I was a little trepidatious that some of the things wouldn't stand up or that my experience would be different than what it was previously when I was, you know, in my 20s and also in my teens.
Yeah.
Not the case. It's fucking awesome. Just everything about it is great. It's so much fun from the very beginning. Even when you're just listening to Cypher and Trinity on the phone looking at Matrix code.
Well, that that opening, that was the first thing I wrote down when I was watching it the other night. The amount of tension that the Wachowskis are able to wring out of two people speaking very vaguely about something that you don't understand off screen, while all we're seeing on screen is the green code start to build, and it's like a phone trace program. And then we're flying through the green code. Like, it's just design, and there's movement, and the score is great. The crazy Don yep. Davis, like techno and brass score, and the sound design of the actual digits of the code as we're flying through, like yep. the zero. And they get so much tension. 2 minutes in, you are on the edge of your seat and you have no idea what the fuck is happening.
You don't know what they're talking about.
No, but it's just crazy. And also the movie plays it straight. Like, they're giving you the visual language right off the beginning. We are seeing people talk about something that we think is in the real world. We're seeing code while they're talking. We enter into the code, and then that code, ultimately, we exit back through a phone receiver. And then so they're giving you the visual language in the beginning, and they're giving you tension, and they're giving you mystery, and it's all in 2 minutes. And it's just like, it's such an assured way to start a movie. Like, what if the most exciting thing could possibly happen? Two people talk in kind of hushed voices, and then there's numbers on the screen, and that's it. it's wild.
And it gets you so in.
Yeah.
Just, oh God.
Can I give you, so we, my big thing when we were talking about like why I wanted to talk about The Matrix, aside from the fact that it is, you know, a robot apocalypse movie and that I'm thinking about the end times rapidly approaching us all.
Yes.
Is just that it, like, the way that it has reshaped popular culture. So the other night I watched it twice in prep for this episode. And the second time I was just keeping a list of everything in the movie that is instantly iconic and recognizable to everyone.
That you could just say out loud in any sentence.
Or show or somebody show a picture. My wife called it Matrix memes. These are essentially correct, Matrix memes. Yeah. Instantly recognizable.
You have a whole list.
I have a list. All there right, are 32 items on this list.
32?
So we will go through it. This is roughly chronological from their appearance in the movie.
Okay.
Number one, the green coat. Okay. Two, bullet time. Three, the black leather.
The black leather.
Yeah. Four, the agent look. And specifically, the agent look is the exact same look as the Men in Black, which was 2 years before. And after this movie, that look means agent. If you see somebody in a white dude in all black suit with a black tie and sunglasses. And
the tie clip, too.
And the tie clip. After this movie, that's not Men in Black anymore. That's the agents.
Right.
Instantly took over that imagery. Five, follow the white rabbit. Obviously, that's a reference to Alice in Wonderland, but like, it is a very specific Matrix evocation. On the 4K box for the movie, the cover is the white rabbit tattoo.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. Six, Mr. Anderson. You can just say Mr. Anderson and people, oh, Matrix. Right. Got it.
That line delivery by Hugo Weaving.
Incredible. It's not just him. It's Mr. Anderson's boss, too.
Yeah, also.
His boss looks kind of like Hugo Weaving and has the same sort of intonation.
Yep.
Another, like, white dude stiff in a, you know, starched collar who's telling him the rules of the world. Number seven, the way Lawrence Fishburne delivers every single line of dialogue. Jamie, let's talk about Cloudy Bay.
What if I told you about Sauvignon Blanc?
There you go. That's much better. I think that is instantly iconic. Also, the Agent Smith voice. Separate from him saying Mr. Anderson, the Agent Smith voice, instantly recognizable.
Feel saturated by it.
It's the smell!
That was one of our things.
Oh, yeah.
Like that, we took that and ran with it for years.
Well, I mean.
And also, you used it as a way to make fun of me.
Well, because it's the smell.
I get it.
It's the smell. Number nine, the Morpheus look.
Yeah.
The look of Morpheus, instantly recognizable.
The floating sunglasses.
The floating sunglasses, the like.
The big, broad, green or purple tie.
The bright ties, the like purple and black suits, and the like green turtle shell, like trench coat, instantly recognizable. Number 10, the room with the high-backed red chairs. The room where Morpheus gives him the red pill and the blue pill.
Yep.
That room, that setting, that the whole direction of that scene, instantly recognizable. Number 11, red pill and blue pill, which is a whole thing that we do not need to unpack today. But
let's get into it, Scott.
That has taken on about a new cultural importance.
Let's talk about the red pill Reddit page. How about it?
No, I don't want to, but I will talk about my favorite tweet probably ever which was sometime, not last year, maybe it was 2019, I don't know, somewhere in the recent apocalyptic hellscape of the administration, Elon Musk tweeted out something about, see, this is why we've all got to take the red pill. And then Ivanka retweeted it and said, yeah, I'm right there with you. Take the red pill. And then I believe it was Lily Wachowski replied to them and said, fuck the both of you.
That's so fucking good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was sometime during the hellscape of the presidency. I had blessedly avoided even knowing what the red pill had come to signify.
The red pill movement, Jamie. They're a movement.
I fucking know. And friend of the pod, D, is the one who made me aware of it. And she linked
against
me.
Against your will.
Against
I'm
my
sure.
will. Linked me to that Reddit page, which I, admittedly, it's on me. I clicked the link.
Well, that's just one of the rules, Jamie. We never look at Reddit. Never look at Reddit. Never look at the comments.
And then I spent, I think, 2 hours reading shit on that Reddit page, like white knuckle rage. And then I got very, very drunk to cleanse myself of all of that shit.
Well, that's on you, Jamie. You did that to yourself.
Yes, I did that to yourself. No, nobody's fault but mine. Anyway, okay,
let's see. We're about a third of the way through my list. Number 12, the human egg goo tubes, the human fields and the harvesters, right? All of that imagery, instantly recognizable. That's the Matrix. The construct, the white void, like loading area where, and then Morpheus explaining everything to Neo with the same red high back chairs. I think that stuff, that imagery is all instantly recognizable.
100%.
The dojo fight. Everything about the dojo fight. The music.
The music.
The music rules.
Oh, God.
But you could play the first
measure of that music to me. And I would be like,
Morpheus
and Neo are fighting.
It's the dojo fight. Yeah. Number 15, the jump program. Mm-hmm. The jump program, number 16, free your mind. And then number 17, whoa. All three of these things happen in the same 30 seconds, but they are independently recognizable like memes from this movie.
That's correct.
The Oracle. Number 19, a glitch in the Matrix or the idea of a deja vu.
Yep.
Or a deja vu being a glitch in the Matrix. Number 20, an agent taking over someone. The visual of an agent taking over somebody's body, I think, is instantly recognizable. Number 21, the lobby shootout, an all-time great action sequence. And I think that's the only reason the movie has an R rating. I really do. Just because of the like pervasive, intense gun violence there. Otherwise, it should be a PG-13. Number 22, the agent dodging Neo's shots on the rooftop. And then immediately after that, Neo's big bullet time dodge, where he's like leaning backwards, like halfway over the ground.
I actually had the thought, the agent dodging bullets.
Yeah.
This last watch through, I noticed that it only happened once in the whole movie. If you had asked me at any time prior to that,
you'd say they do it all the time.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and if it was, I'm not worried about this with Resurrections, which by the time this episode drops, we will have already seen and probably talked about a bunch. But in a modern day, like action blockbuster where like, this is a whole thing to get into. Let's table that for a second.
I want to
come back to that. Number 25. The helicopter minigun slow motion sprinkler rescue.
Oh my God.
I say dodge this? Because dodge this is the other one.
You did not say dodge this.
The agent dodging, Neo dodging, 24, dodge this.
Yep.
Number 25, the helicopter rescue with Neo shooting the minigun in slow motion to free Morpheus. 26, the helicopter crash and Trinity jumping and then swinging in slow motion and then hitting the glass.
The wave explosion that happens.
Yeah, the ripple. Circular ripple of the glass. 27, Morpheus's mid-fight bring it taunt that he does in the dojo and then later Neo does to taunt Smith to say, come on, the little come over, come hither, kung fu hand gesture. Number 28, any number of Neo's moves from the big fight with Smith on the subway platform. Like, there are a number of them, like whether it's the two of them jumping at each other and like bullet time dodging while it swings around.
Yep. I mean, that shot alone
is
iconic and recognizable. That whole them shooting at each other and then landing.
Concentric bullet circle trail things behind them.
You're empty.
So are you. God, Keanu's so great in the movie. And then three in a row, risen. So like, you know, he died and now he's back. Risen Neo stopping the bullets, holding out his hand and stopping the bullets. Risen Neo seeing the code, seeing the world and the agents all in green code. And then Risen Neo diving into Smith and exploding him.
Yep.
All happened in the span of 30 seconds. And they are three different instantly recognizable landmark moments.
Now, would you include Risen Neo saying no in his stopping of the bullets or as a separate one?
I don't think of the no as much as just the visual think of him stopping the bullets.
Him looking at them shooting and just going no.
It's a good one.
Yeah, it's a really good one.
Yeah. And then finally, Neo threatening the machines over a payphone and then flying off into the sky to rage against the machine, which is, I think, one of the all-time great movie endings.
Yes.
It is crazy how much, like, the only thing comparable to it in, like, in today's movie landscape, and you're going to hate this.
Okay. I'm ready to hate something.
It's the Marvel movies. It's the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But it has also taken them 25 movies, and I don't think they have a list this long of things that are, like, as instantly recognizable as just this one singular Matrix movie. Like, it has taken them a decade of dominating, you know, the box office and dominating the genre worldwide.
Yeah, and this was this was sophomore film from two filmmakers.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a ton of Marvel shit that has, like, worked its way into popular culture. Like, there's no denying it.
Well, yeah, and speaking as someone who largely hasn't seen those movies.
Right.
The only one off the top of my head that has reached me, I don't actually know which Avengers movie it's from,
right,
but all of them assembling against,
yeah,
presumably, what's his name?
Thanos?
Thanos, yeah.
Yeah, this is the big thing, the portals moment from the end of Avengers Endgame.
And it gets changed into, like, people will, like, superimpose, yeah, their heads on it and do a whole thing. Yeah, yeah. That's reached me,
right?
I have seen that scene probably 20 to 30 times as different memes.
I got to tell you, I'm getting chills just thinking about it. Those movies are troubled, and we spent too much time trying not to talk about them, but there is some magic in them from time to time.
I'm going to get that list of the 7 or 8 that you think I need to see.
We're going to do it, girl. We're going to do it. You can watch them here.
Anyway, talking about the cultural impact of these things.
The enormous cultural impact.
The question that I'd like to pose,
and
that we can maybe talk about together, is what the fuck exactly about this movie burrowed into our consciousness like a weasel? Is it just superlative quality? Was it a time and place thing? Was it marketing? Like, what is it?
Well, so the marketing part is an interesting question. I think the thing about marketing, and, like, you cannot deny the marketing on this movie. I don't know how much you remember, but it was a big multimedia marketing campaign. There was the website, whatisthematrix.com.
Oh, I forgot about that.
It was, yeah, the first time I remember movie trailers and commercials ending with a push for the website. Like, the trailer would end with, visit whatisthematrix.com. And you would go to the site, and they would have, like, flash animations and trailers and, like, hints at, like, world building, but still, you know, right, holding back the big reveals.
Yeah, I remember that.
The website was huge. Obviously, the Wachowskis went way further in the sequels with the major multimedia campaign.
And the Animatrix.
The Animatrix and the video game and, yep, all the other shit. Did you know why, I don't know if this is why, but this is one of the excuses that's been bandied about, why Lawrence Fishburne is not in Matrix Resurrections?
No.
Because Morpheus canonically died in the Matrix Online MMO. Which the Wachowskis, okay, were, like, heavily involved in, like, scripting the overall direction of, wow, the story of the Matrix Online.
All right.
Morpheus canonically dies.
Sure. That's fine.
But no, so I think the thing about, like, the marketing is huge for that movie, but the marketing is only gets you to the opening weekend.
Yeah. So it was, like, I don't know, how many months of whipping the nation into a froth?
I don't remember how long, but yeah, I mean, it'd probably been 6 months between the first trailer and the movie actually coming out.
Yeah.
But yeah, the marketing will only ever get you to the opening weekend, which, of course, the studios have now all realized, which is why you'll have a bunch of movies, like we have talked before, and you were incredulous about it, but about the existence of the movie Suicide Squad, I think it was 2015, a movie that no one liked, was terribly reviewed, was received so poorly that the studio decided to basically scrap everything and hire a new director to come in and do a soft reboot, and it still made $800 million. And it's
insanity.
And it's because,
like, what the fuck?
It's because of the marketing. If they have great,
yeah,
marketing and a killer trailer, like, they're going to spend $100 million marketing it no matter what, which is how much they spend to market these things now. $100 million in global marketing.
Good.
The marketing gets you through opening weekend, and then it's word of mouth.
Right.
So especially if your movie is not good, like, you better get them all in on the opening weekend, which for, like, a lot of these movies now, like, they do 70% of their business in the first 3 days. This is another digression, but, like, we talk a lot about, like, or I think a lot about what's popular and why it's popular, mm-hmm, and what lasts in the culture, right? And I'm pretty opposed to, like, how do I put this? I think when something is a monumental hit, there has to be something that is registering with audiences, right? Like, you don't get to be a $1 billion hit just based on good marketing.
That's correct.
Like, that is only your first weekend. You can be...
It can move the needle.
You can be a $300 million domestic hit just based on good marketing. But, like, if you want to go the long haul and be a colossal hit, even if you don't make a dent in the zeitgeist, like, it needs to be good in some way that audiences resonate with. And sometimes that distresses me, like with Jurassic World, which is like a $1 billion hit, and people fucking love that movie. And I think it's just weaponized pornographic nostalgia.
I have not seen
it. It's utterly meaningless.
Don't really want to.
Useless. It's terrible.
Yeah.
The second one is kind of okay, though.
I'm going to avoid it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so it gets you to opening weekend.
I think for this movie, yes, it is superlative quality. Like, it's just fucking good. It's super well made, but it's also the right style at the right moment. And I mean style in terms of like the stuff in the movie, like the wardrobe and the, like, the not steampunk, but like the sort of like crunchy, anachronistic, like grungy tech of it all.
Yeah.
The black leather, the like insane stylization of the world of the Matrix and the way everybody behaves and everybody's cool as fuck with red sunglasses in the Matrix. I think all of that was the right moment, or the right style and the right attitude at the moment.
I did have the thought as I was watching it that there's such a marked difference in the performances from the Matrix to the real world.
Yeah.
And it's as though they are video game avatars.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can see it even in just like body language. Morpheus doesn't move when he's in the Matrix. And if he does move, it's only when he has to. He is otherwise very still. Like, you think about the scene where he explains it, right? Where red pill, blue pill, and no one can be told what the Matrix is. You can only be shown, right?
Yeah.
Or you have to see it to believe it. Morpheus is in that like red high back chair, and he's just sitting there perfectly upright with his like hands steepled in front of him with like one leg crossed. And he doesn't move the entire conversation until it's time to give Neo the two pills. And meanwhile, Keanu is like, he's all angular and contorted and his arms are up and he's leaning in really, really close to Morpheus. And then he's pulled back and he's freaked out. Like, The dynamism of his physical performance compared to just how rigid Fishburne is. And then when they're back in the real world,
Fishburne is hunched over.
Well, he's sometimes warm and he seems more affectionate. And he's just like, it's a totally different affect. Yeah, it's style, but it's also like it's story. It's the storytelling. It's the broad way that the metaphor tracks for a lot of people and tracks for some people very, very specifically and profoundly.
What do you mean the way it tracks? Like the way people relate to it?
The way that the central conceit of the movie, to speak very broadly, of like the idea that reality is not your reality and you are in some way trapped and imprisoned and forced to live your life a certain way and go to your job a certain way and represent yourself a certain way. We look at that now, and we look at that in the context of the Wachowskis now. And for me, it is very hard not to look at this as like a trans allegory. Right. Like the two of them were clearly dealing with this shit 25 years ago when they were working on this movie. And I find it very affecting to see that like they went from a place where they're credited as the Wachowski brothers on this movie. And now 20 odd years later, like it's Lana Wachowski is directing the new one. Like that they went from being closeted about it to now like being able to live their own truth. But you can see it and it's all right there. Like the Matrix was still very resonant and personal to them in that way then. And I think it played that way very specifically to some audiences who felt like their bodies were a prison that their mind was trapped inside. But I think it's also like it takes something specific for them and turns it into like an accessible science fiction package where the enemy is robots and AI and shit and you get to do cool kung fu, that you're able to like smooth out the metaphor and people can read whatever they want into it. It's Star Wars, Jamie. It's 21st century Star Wars. This is why the movie is so unbelievably popular and has landed in culture, is because they took a lot of things that people were feeling and a lot of philosophies from around the world and a lot of like big ideas about existentialism and about like broader spirituality and about the anxieties about technology and about like budding, you know, simulacra, or like the idea of simulation theory. And they took all of these things and they synthesized it into like one perfect pop culture artifact. And I think that is why, like if that is the biggest metaphor or the biggest parallel for me for the Matrix, is that it's just Star Wars for the 21st century. it's not for children the same way that Star Wars is essentially for children.
Right.
But yeah, I think that's why it landed like a bomb in pop culture. Because it does all the things right that George Lucas did right in 77.
Huh. How much do you think was, say, 1998, they're in production on this movie, right? Do they know what they have on their hands?
Do they know that they're about to rewrite, you know, the American popular culture landscape?
Yes.
I don't know. Somebody did, you know, somebody sure as hell felt like, and they had the backing of Joel Silver, who was like a major, like, Hollywood mega producer in the late 80s and the 90s. And he was in their corner from the beginning and has always been like a super supportive producer for them, to my understanding. But like, yeah, I mean, somebody got what they were doing. I'm sure it scared the hell out of the studio. It was a pretty expensive movie to make. And these two did not really have like Bound is like a couple million dollar, like super indie movie that didn't make a whole lot of money and didn't really get seen by a lot of people. Like,
I haven't seen it.
Oh, dude.
It's good.
That is an insanely assured first feature. But Bound, the Wachowskis' first feature, it's 1996.
Okay.
And it's a noir. And it's Gina Gershon and Jennifer Tilly and Joey Pants. And it's
Joey Pants.
Like, it's the two women, like the two leads, have a passionate affair in the beginning of the movie with one of the best and most tasteful and hottest sex scenes I have ever seen in my life. And it's one shot and you basically see no nudity, and it is more intimate and erotic than like anything I've seen in much more explicit sex scenes.
Wow. You really have a way of selling these things.
Dude, you should watch Bound. And then after the first act, which is like all the like romantic tension and the setup, it becomes a crackerjack fucking thriller, like a crazy like noir gangster thriller. It's so rad.
Okay.
You would love it.
I'm sold.
But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they knew knew what they had on there.
Joel Silver may have sniffed it a little bit, or at least thought he could make money.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, Warner Brothers, like, they threw money at it. It was not an inexpensive movie to make. But like, did the Wachowskis know like how big of a thing it was gonna be? Who fucking knows? Do you know what else came out that year in 1999?
Not off the top of my head.
It was just a few, so the number one movie of the year in 1999.
Was it The Phantom Menace?
It was The Phantom Menace.
Yes.
The Phantom Menace, which came out a few weeks after this movie did.
Wow.
Yeah. And while The Phantom Menace, that was number one at the domestic box office, it made $474 million. The Matrix was number five, making $173. But one of those movies has lasted in the culture in a much deeper and more resonant and affectionate way.
Yes.
And the other one is Star Wars The Phantom Menace. But Jamie, 1999 was crazy. This is the other thing for me about The Matrix, is that the way it has survived in culture in ways that a lot of other movies have not. Mm-hmm. The steep competition for like room in people's like mental library after 1999 concludes. So you got The Matrix, you have Phantom Menace, The Sixth Sense, Toy Story 2, The Mummy, The Blair Witch Project, The Green Mile, American Beauty, Notting Hill, American Pie, Sleepy Hollow, The Talented Mr. Ripley, Galaxy Quest.
Fucking Galaxy Quest.
The Thomas Crown Affair, Bowfinger, Three Kings, Eyes Wide Shut.
Wow.
The South Park Movie.
The South Park Movie.
Fight Club, Man on the Moon, Mystery Men, The Insider, The Iron Giant, Being John Malkovich, Magnolia.
Wow.
Yeah, 99. Oh, there's even more on here. What else?
There are a lot there that have had significant cultural impact.
Yeah. I mean, 99 is a big deal in the movies, but I don't think there's anything bigger than The Matrix. Even when like Blair Witch and The Sixth Sense and Star Wars, like The Matrix still looms over all of it.
I feel like there could be an argument that I would not be the one to articulate for The Sixth Sense artifact.
It's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it resonated the way that The Matrix has, but you know, that's arguable.
Yeah, just everybody gets The Matrix. Yeah. And you're right. Everyone fucking relates to it in their own specific way.
In your own way. Yeah. And you know, a lot of it is just like good performances and it's good writing. And then there's just like shit that you can't forget in this movie. Like, this movie has genuinely provocative visuals.
Yes.
The reveal of Neo in the tank when they give him the red pill, and then he does the thing with the mirror, and then he wakes up in the tank. Even having seen that movie, I don't know, a couple dozen times since it came out, it is still disturbing and horrifying. And the realization, the dawning realization that I remember being in the theater And because they were very good about, like, they showed you the bullet time in the trailers and they showed you the martial arts and all the weird sci-fi shit, but they still never actually told you what it was.
Yeah.
And I remember getting to that point and being completely unprepared and totally baffled and feeling like anything could happen for the rest of the movie. It was one of those moments where you get to, like, the turn in the story and you realize literally anything could happen and I have no roadmap for what I'm about to see here.
That's right.
Like him in the pink goo with all the hoses and shit coming out of him.
It's scary.
It's genuinely really frightening.
You can see the performance is great of him waking up and not knowing what the hell is going on. And the realization that he's got a thing sticking out the back of his head that all plays intensely well. And then the machine comes down to unhook him. Mm-hmm. And that's terrifying because it's like got him by the neck.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, my blood pressure is up even thinking about it. You're right. I hadn't thought back to the first viewing. Like you just called back to the idea that anything could have happened from that point. That's true, and awesome.
It's very exciting. And it doesn't really happen, certainly not with like big budget spectacle movies, especially not these days where everything is kind of sanded down and homogenized. You know, I always feel safe watching big franchise shit now. You don't feel safe watching The Matrix. It feels dangerous.
Yeah.
And it feels transgressive in a lot of ways as well.
That is one of those words that you used when we were discussing this pairing.
Yeah. The imagery is unsettling. The thing that it has to say about your relationship to your body, like your mind's relationship to your body, are both profound and disturbing, and they're not easy things to really like wrap your head around.
The body cannot live without the mind.
The body cannot live without the mind. This is something that occurred to me watching it the other night, and it had never, I have this like vague recollection of always being a little uncertain as to what the Morpheus and his crew, the crew of the Nebuchadnezzar, what their plan is when they give Neo the red pill. So they give him the red pill.
Yeah.
They say it's like something that's meant to disrupt the carrier wave of his transmission.
So they can get his location.
And to get his location. But so it's to get him to stop broadcasting into the Matrix. So it's disrupting his carrier wave. It's to get him to stop inputting his own body into the Matrix. And it's a tracer so they can find his body. Right. But then what happens? He wakes up in the puddle of like pink goo and almost immediately all of the hoses and shit start popping off of him. And then the machine comes down, the nursery sentinel, and picks him up and looks at him and then drops him back in the goo. And then the drain opens up and dumps him out.
Yes.
I don't know. Maybe this is just like super obvious to people, but it never crystallized for me until watching it the other night that the machine comes down, assesses him basically. And it's like, oh, this one's conscious. He's no good to us anymore.
Yes.
He cannot be used. He cannot be a battery. I think the idea implicit is we cannot reinsert him back into the Matrix.
That's correct.
His mind has been awoken, so we're going to discard him. And then he goes down, and now the Nebuchadnezzar crew knows where to go to pick his body up before he's like dissolved and fed back to the babies.
Yep.
Which means that everything that Morpheus said about like, sorry, like the red pill is a one-way trip, you know, you can't go back in, is true. And that the agents were lying to Cypher when they told him they were going to put him back in and take away all of his memories. And
yes.
Shit. Maybe it's just like a very obvious bit of plotting, but it also resonates in a big way. Like once you are awakened to the truth of your reality, it is impossible to go back to sleep.
I remember early viewings thinking it was a little bizarre and convenient that he was just dumped out. It seems to me a little bizarre that the machines would see one that wakes up and just dump it out.
Yeah. For
presumably knowing that this is how the resistance gets populated.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like they have a good plan for stopping the, well, except that we learn.
We find out later.
We find out later on. Yeah.
That it's all a system of control.
It is all a system of control. But speaking of systems, you got a thing and then you said systems of control. There are things that they do in the sequels that connect back to this one in ways that I find very effective. The scene with the architect at the end of Matrix Reloaded, where he's just explaining everything to Neo, all of the video screens in the architect's like room that we fly in and out of and we see the different iterations of Neo, right?
Yep.
They are the same screens and it's the same visual language of flying into the screen as when the agents first bring in Neo in the beginning of this movie and we see him on the surveillance cameras. So it's just a way of reinforcing for him like subconsciously, like no, this is just another layer of control. You were always without power. You never had any influence to control anything. And we've just been waiting for you, just like when we picked you up with the agents in the beginning and they put the fucking bug in your belly button. Like, we've just been waiting for you this whole time to get to this point because this is our system of control. And I thought that visual callback that I never really connected before, like, really plays in a big way.
Yeah, that this most recent rewatching, the one where I did all three in a row,
yeah,
was the first that I made that connection. Those screens being the same screens. And I was like, that's fucking cool.
Yeah.
I think you did a very spectacular job of answering my question of what exactly it is about this movie. And like, there's a part of me that did want to hear its superlative quality.
But it is that. Like, that's what I was saying. It is superlative quality, and it's the substance, and it's the moment, and it's, you know, arriving at the right time.
But as we get older and we see the way the world works and... And we get disheartened and upset and whatever, it seems to me so infrequent that the superlative quality of a thing is what makes it successful. Especially because knowing as we do that capitalism is broken and terrible.
Yeah.
The things that are the best are not necessarily the most successful things.
Right.
And in fact, frequently are the less successful things.
Yeah.
This is one of those rare exceptions where the superlative quality lines up with the, I guess, capitalist thirst around it. It taps into the coolness that people want and the pace and the action and the all of that while also having so much going for it. And those things aren't separate. They're in fact linked.
Yeah.
Completely. It makes me feel good to hear that is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That good things can succeed.
Yeah, good things can succeed, and good things can succeed on their own merit. I mean, like I was saying, like, it, the marketing will only ever get you to opening weekend. And for a lot of movies, that's enough. Opening weekend is enough to, you know, be fine and move on. But then if you want to last, if you want to make big bucks, if you want to last in people's memories, like, you got to get people talking, you know?
But even, I mean, obviously, you and I care a little bit less about how much money this made, how much money this movie made than we care about the impact that it had on us as teenagers and the impact that it had on our contemporaries and on society writ large.
Yeah. But I also do care about how much money it makes. Like, for as much as I want to be like, oh, the box office doesn't matter. And what matters to me is art and the primacy of artistry and all of that. Like, no, like it matters to me when things that are good are rewarded financially, because it means that those people get to keep working.
Correct. Yeah.
And that it means that, like, something that is great is, in theory, like, being appreciated in its time. Like, I was thinking about this the other day, where next year will be the 15th anniversary of Speed Racer. And I'm sure the Wachowskis would be thrilled if, for some reason, Warner Brothers was like, you know what? We've got a pretty light slate next year. Let's do a 4K IMAX exclusive re-release of Speed Racer to celebrate its anniversary. And if the culture had finally caught up to that movie, which always felt like it was a couple of years ahead of the curve.
Yep.
And if Speed Racer suddenly, like, became a big hit, and, like, I'm sure they'd feel great about it now, but also, like, that must have really fucking hurt that you put all those years of your life into something and then just no one goes to see it and it's a laughingstock, which is insane.
That's insane.
Yeah. That movie was, like, laughed out of theaters, essentially.
I can't imagine being one of those people.
No, but I can imagine those people.
I honestly can't. I haven't interacted with any of them.
With anyone who doesn't like Speed Racer?
Well, I haven't talked about Speed Racer with anyone who is anything less than effusive about it.
Right. It is wild, the wilderness that the Wachowskis lived in after The Matrix, essentially. So do you remember how bad things were for them after Matrix Reloaded?
I do not.
So this one did 173 at the old domestic box office. Huge hit. Matrix Reloaded, 4 years later, huge story that it was the biggest R-rated opening of all time. It did $281 million domestic. Matrix Revolutions, 6 months later, $139 million.
Wow.
Because people fucking hated Reloaded so much.
I remember being one of those people.
I remember being very frustrated by it. I remember hating Revolutions. I remember really disliking Revolutions, but Reloaded, I remember liking much of, but not all of.
I just remember complaining about it a lot and loudly.
I remember being disappointed by the ending of Reloaded, and in particular, much of Revolutions. But yeah, and then after that, they produced V for Vendetta. They made Speed Racer. They made Cloud Atlas. They made Jupiter Ascending. And then they spent a few years working on a Netflix series, Sense8, which I have seen a little bit of and I really need to give another shot to. And then they're coming back with another Matrix movie. But like they basically...
They've been out in the woods.
Well, they follow this trajectory that like a lot of filmmakers do, which is like M. Night Shyamalan has a very similar trajectory, like a huge hit very early in your career. And once you make somebody $1 billion, they're going to let you, you know, fail a bunch of times, essentially.
Right.
And so, you know, they made their Matrix trilogy and then just like a bunch of very expensive, highfalutin, like fantasy or like sci-fi genre, but like very esoteric and idiosyncratic versions.
Jupiter Ascending rules.
Jupiter Ascending rules, but like was an enormous failure. Cloud Atlas was very expensive and had to be like internationally financed because nobody would want to pay for their big swing for it. And it made very little money comparatively. And Speed Racer was just a calamitous flop and a failure. And it breaks my heart to have that impact on culture in your career so early on. And then to just spend like the next decade and a half just kind of like trying to figure it out and just keep burning Warner Brothers' money, you know, like God bless him.
Yeah. And then coming back.
And now she's coming back to do another one, which on the one hand is kind of disappointing. Like, oh, does she have to, you know? But at the same time, like, I don't think they have to. I feel like she wants to do something with it. I'm so excited.
Obviously, this is a movie about some kind of apocalypse, but I think that you have a slightly more specific take.
Well, I mean, so of your core flavors of like apocalyptic scenario. So we've already done nuclear apocalypse.
Yep.
And we've done kaiju related apocalypse.
Yes.
And this movie fits firmly into the genre of robot apocalypse, right? The AI machine uprising. And I think when it came out in 99, it very much like resonated for me in that particular way. Like 99 was like the year, I think 98, we got our first DVD player. And the first DVD I got was Terminator 2, which I watched, I don't know, 100 times in that first year. So like, it was easy for me to like just look at it as a robot apocalypse movie. But I think, and this could just be me projecting, but I feel like the cultural legacy of this movie is less about robot uprising than it is about presaging the end of reality by the introduction of a virtual reality.
I think this movie has aged into 2021 well through that lens.
Yes, exactly.
I'm not willing to say necessarily that it will be the lasting thing because we don't know what the future holds.
There's still time for a robot uprising.
There's still time for a robot uprising. It may happen while we're plugged into an alternate virtual reality. But you're...
The verse, Jamie. We got to get on the metaverse. You're going to have to make us some meta accounts so people can... virtually listen to the podcast. I don't know how does that work?
Would we? I don't understand. They would just like sit down on the couch here virtually as we are recording it.
I don't think that would be good for anyone.
No, it's uncomfortable for everybody.
Yeah, that feels like that ruins the point of a podcast.
And just like watching us squirm.
Yeah,
and like watching me try and stretch my back because it always hurts.
Yeah, and I'm sweating, and Jamie picks his nose all the time, and. I don't know. Why would you virtually listen to or watch a podcast?
But all of that being said, follow us on all of the social media.
Right. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
Powered by Meta.
Both Meta companies.
Oh my God. Yeah.
But that's what I feel though. On the apocalypse terror scale, AI uprising is like simmering around like a 3 out of 10 for me now. But the technological replacement of reality with, if not a simulation, then something unreal and virtual is very, very high. I feel the reality slipping away from us.
I'm with you on that. However, I think that my fear of AI is a little bit higher than a 3.
Mm.
As I mentioned earlier, when we were talking about how we get engagement on the social media, in a very real way, even the people who wrote the algorithms that govern what gets put in front of our faces don't know the variables that they are weighting and how heavily they are weighted. These are self-learning programs already that have surpassed our understanding already.
But I'm not worried about them turning us into batteries, though. Unless the thing that powers them is like us depleting our souls by staring at these fucking screens all day.
Sure, maybe. Or they just outright kill all of us. That's the simpler solution, I think.
Hmm. But how would they do that, Jamie? how could the machines possibly kill us all? It's not like we've all invited them into our homes with a bunch of cameras and microphones masquerading as consumer convenience devices that allow them to not only listen and observe all of our conversations, but also control our lights, our heating, our air conditioning. They fucking pay our bills half the time. And we've got, you know, camera doorknobs that invite the police into our houses and facial recognition software. Jamie, how would your Amazon Echo possibly get you killed, Jamie?
Oh, I don't know. It's a pretty far-fetched kind of thing. Probably, I'm probably just being hysterical.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
The robots are coming.
Get those fucking devices out of your houses, y'all. Just walk across the room and use the thermostat, okay? It's not that much of a convenience.
It really isn't.
I have 3 smart bulbs in my house and I regret all 3 of them. And they all have microphones somehow. Why do they have microphones in the light bulbs?
So that they can hear you.
And then buy shit for me.
I am, and I think in some way because of this movie.
Because of The Matrix.
Just distrustful of the computers a little bit. Yeah. And I have the assistant blocked on my phone. I don't use the voice commands at all. I don't have an Alexa. I don't have a Ring. I don't, like, my thermostat is a regular ass thermostat. And maybe I'm wrong, but I feel safer a little bit.
No, I feel a lot safer. Did you see the thing that Amazon was slinging recently?
Oh, please. What is it?
It's like one of their little screens, like a tablet, right? And it's like, it's the virtual assistant. And what is Amazon's called? Amazon is Alexa, right?
Amazon is, well, the thing is Echo, but right. the assistant is Alexa.
It's an Echo robot.
Oh, no.
That can wheel itself around your house.
Of course
it can. In theory, it's supposed to help you with things like, I don't know, like the robots at the supermarket that like announce over the PA that there's a spill in aisle 11 now. But in your house, but really it's just a little spy robot that can look around your whole house and take pictures of all of your shit.
Oh, my God. I hate
and
it.
And send it to Amazon servers so that Amazon can tell you, hey, it looks like you're... There's a hole in your t-shirt in your closet. You should buy a new one. Here's a link for an auto subscribe for a 10 pack of t-shirts.
Oh my Lord.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, they're illegally obstructing unions from being established within their company. Anyway, I can't talk about Amazon anymore.
I think the one thing that The Matrix gets wrong is that there's not enough selling of shit in The Matrix. That's the thing that the machines are missing out on, is that they could also be getting us to subscribe for streaming services while harnessing all of our BTUs.
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah.
Fucking. Okay. Well, now that you've beaten me down with all of that.
Yes.
I get to beat you down.
What?
With the bad reviews game.
Jamie, but it's The Matrix. Who could possibly have bad things to say about The Matrix internet?
Some people had bad things to say about The Matrix.
All right. I've decided I don't like this already.
Bad reviews. Let's proceed. By the way, is the game where Scott has to listen to negative user reviews from the internet and decide whether they're about the movie or the wine, all while clinging to his last shreds of sanity.
All right. Lay it on me, Jamie.
All right. Bad review number 1. Always gives me a headache and rates very bland.
Always gives me a headache and rates very bland.
Yes.
That has to be the wine.
That is the wine, correct.
Because I know people get headaches from wine, although this is a pretty loud movie. But The Matrix is not bland. This wine is not bland either. This wine is very flavorful.
I agree.
But I can't imagine anyone describing The Matrix as bland.
This person is an idiot.
Well, it's possible.
Yeah. RF, 1-star Vivino. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. Next one. Anyone who thinks this movie... Damn it. I fucked it up.
Yeah, you did.
It was supposed to be redacted.
It's too bad. You should actually redact those so that you don't do that.
Yeah, I really should.
All right, well, let's just hear it anyway.
Yeah, okay. Damn it. Okay, anyone who thinks this movie is great is an imbecile. Unfortunately, this country is rife with imbeciles.
Is that the wine? No, that's the movie.
Brian M., 1 out of 10 on Metacritic.
On Metacritic. Yeah. A Metacritic user review. I didn't realize Metacritic let people make user reviews.
Yeah, it's not a good place.
Metacritic is a good place, but well, it's the comments, Jamie. Comments are never good anywhere. All right, give me the next one.
This next one, you're going to have to bleep a word in here because I would prefer to not say this word out loud publicly.
But you're still going to say it.
But I'm
going
to say it to you.
So you have to say it and I have to hear it. And can't you just not say it? Is it important for me to hear it?
It is. Because it's offensive. It's okay. Not a good word.
Okay. All right, great. Cool.
Only like this redacted. Wow. Yeah.
That is not a nice word.
It's not a nice word.
It's not a nice word.
I don't like it.
Only bleeps like this word, or like this blank.
Redacted, yes.
The movie?
It's the movie. That's right.
Wow.
This is...
That was uninspired. That was Egan just crass.
A, 0 out of 10 Metacritic.
I have nothing to say to that other than I can't help you.
And lastly, tried to give it 0.5 star, but the app won't allow it.
Is that the wine?
That is the wine.
And what app are they referring to?
Vivino.
You should let people leave 0.5 star reviews, Vivino.
Apparently, do they not you're not
let
allowed
you do
to.
Halves at all?
You can do 1.5.
Like, oh, weird.
But you can't do 0.5 star.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Letterboxd has that too, where the lowest review you can give something is 0.5 star. You can't give it 0 stars. That's just you didn't rate it. So huh. The lowest you can give is 0.5 star, which is fine. I think the lowest I've ever rated anything was 1 star or 1.5 stars. And that wasn't even something that was so terrible. I was just mad at it.
So those are the four. I biffed one, so we'll give it to you. You got 4 out of 4.
I nailed it. You nailed it. I nailed it, y'all.
I want to give you some of the key phrases that were used in broadly the bad reviews of The Matrix on the internet.
Okay, good. Let's do this.
Plot holes, derivative, incoherent plot, bad acting, dumb, vapid, idiotic.
Okay, so plot holes, amazing. This is a pretty immaculately plotted movie. Derivative is insane. What do they think it's derivative of?
I would read these reviews and they would just say this film is derivative of so many things that I've seen before. And it would just be so many things that I've seen before. I'm like, could you? An example. Yeah. One.
Derivative and then bad acting. So what they're talking about is Keanu there, which is fucking not fair. This movie does not work without Keanu Reeves.
I agree.
Keanu rules in this movie.
He's pretty pitch perfect.
And he's perfect at all levels of it. You know what is a great little Keanu moment in the movie? It's a thing that he's good at. He is a great physical actor. When they take like a little pause during the dojo fight, right?
Yeah.
And after Morpheus, Neo did like the backflip and then Morpheus kicks him in the chest and he breaks the beam and falls down and he's panting.
And they do the thing where, do you think that me being faster or stronger has anything to do with my muscles in here? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, specifically what he says after that is, do you think that's air you're breathing? And Neo, panting and sweating, looks at him, holds his breath, and he just stops being out of breath. Like, what a little physical thing to do that communicates huge volumes. It's like, it's the beginning of his understanding that my brain can be untethered from my physical reality.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you. And then also dumb, vapid, idiotic. Those last three is just like,
you just can't help. You just can't help some people.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to give you one honorable mention here, and it's a wine review because I just think it's funny.
Oh, okay. Well, I like things that are funny.
1995, forgotten in cellar, now vinegar. 1 star.
That doesn't seem fair.
Why even come online that to write that review?
Well, it's like when you look on like Amazon reviews and people go to like I'll see like Amazon movie reviews and it's like, I meant to get the new one, but this is the old one. 1 star. Like,
that's on you, man.
Come on. Internet reviews. Internet reviews are terrible.
They really are. Just people screaming into the void, hoping to get noticed.
That's what they're doing.
Yep.
That's all any of us can do.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Hey, it's Future Scott here. So obviously we went real long on The Matrix, real long. And you know what? You have been a loyal listener and you do not deserve a punishing 2-hour episode of me and Jamie to close out or possibly start up your year, depending on when you listen to this one. So happy new year, y'all. We're doing a 2-parter. 2-parters are great. Everybody likes a 2-parter. Do you actually like 2-parters? Do you not like when we do 2-parters? The listening metrics analytics are a little inconclusive on whether or not people are digging it. Let us know. Anyway, sorry. Come back for next week's equally lengthy discussion of Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc. We'll talk about if the pairing works, and of course, we'll play the classic podcast game, Wife Takes. In the meantime, follow the show on all the socials at Bigger Bottle Pod, and you can email any questions, comments, or suggestions to biggerbottlepod@gmail.com. Please follow or subscribe wherever it is you listen to podcasts. And leave us a review and a rating on Apple Podcasts, please. And we will read it on the air. And now you can leave ratings for podcasts on Spotify. You can do this right through the Spotify app. So our non-Apple Spotify listeners out there who have complained to us that Apple's ratings website sucks, we agree. Here you are. You have a solution, an alternative. Go forth. Giveth 5 stars, please. It will really help the show, and we will love you more if you do that for us. Thank you. This episode was produced and edited by Scott Hudson. That's me, and our social media presence is the fine work of Jamie Harrison Rubin, who is currently on the can. So tune in next week for Jamie's rap debut as DJ Salvi B. Until then, watch more movies, drink more wine, and hey, wasn't The Matrix Resurrections fucking awesome? Like, did you guys see that movie? Ooh, I'm Future Scott. I've seen it. The guys you just spent an hour listening to and will spend another hour listening to next week, they have not seen it yet. Ooh, boy, that was a good movie. Happy New Year, everybody. We'll see you in 2022. Goodbye.
All right, zerts and veg.
Zerts and or veg. Do you have either?
I do, but you seemed excited about yours, so I'm gonna have you go first.
I was excited just about other things. So zerts. I showed my child the Star Wars this week.
That's just wonderful. It warms my heart.
I mean, I have, as you can surmise, pretty complicated feelings about sharing the Star Wars with a child.
Right.
So this is both my zerts and my veg. It's my zerts because we had a delightful time. And it was a very pure experience.
He watched it twice in a week. We love Star Wars.
It's Star Wars. It's delightful. This is probably only the second time I've seen Star Wars in close to 15 years. Like, I just swore them off. After the prequels, I was like, I'm done. I'm not watching this anymore. I'm out. I checked out. I couldn't deal with it anymore. And I think that it was, I think I watched all three of them not long after MB was born.
Okay.
And like, because I downloaded the despecialized editions.
Right.
And I watched all three of those and probably in like the course of a weekend. And it was like, all right, great. Now I can put these to bed until it's time to share them with him. So I had complex feelings. But we watched them. We had a great time. I agonized for 3 days leading up to the day that I finally pulled the trigger and showed them to him as to which version we would watch. Would we watch the 4th iteration of the special edition that is streaming on Disney Plus, or would I buy him the 4K Blues, which I still might do, which is still that 4th iteration special edition, or would I show him either the despecialized version or the alternate fan edit, which is called 4K 77, where they did a 4K scan of a 1977 theatrical run print. And then had a team of digital artists, and they spent like 2 years and $25,000.
Jesus Christ.
Restoring it so that it looks like what it would have looked like had you seen it in theaters in 1977.
I do like nerds.
It's
when
super
they get
cool.
Dedicated to something.
Yeah, it's great. And their whole thing is like, we don't want you to pirate and steal the movies. Like, the whole point of this is that Lucas will not release any other version. So we're doing the work, and we assume that the people who are downloading it are only doing it because they already own a license to Star Wars because they bought it on DVD or something.
Is it somewhere in like the contract for the purchase of Lucasfilm that
I'm sure that it is.
It's fucking insanity.
I'm sure that that's part of the deal, because otherwise, why wouldn't Disney have released a version?
Yeah,
like correct. They would just make money off of it.
It's free money.
It's just free money. They can continue selling the special edition version, and then they can also sell the original version. There were rumors
that man
percolating
is.
Years ago before the sale that they had already started working on a 4K restoration from original elements, like from the 77, the 80, and the 83 versions.
Right.
Because right now, the only version that is like mastered at 2K or at 4K is the special edition cut. So there's rumors that Disney had been working on it, but I feel like if they were going to, they would have at this point.
Right.
It's probably just like a thing that, like, so long as Lucas lives, those versions cannot be legally released anywhere. And then once he dies,
the fucking Warren Commission.
Yeah. But so that was both a positive, being able to share that with MB because he had a blast with it. But then also, you know, I'm opening, it's like I'm it's
Pandora's now, box.
Well, now. It's the Pandora's box of merchandise. And also just like, it's, I'm so conflicted about that evil parent company and all the bad things that they're doing. And now it's just like another revenue stream for them has been opened.
Yeah.
So I don't feel great about that, but we did have a great time watching it and he's not chomping at the bit to watch the others. So we're just going to take our time. And I figure we'll probably do Empire, I don't know, maybe around Christmas and then Return of the Jedi not long after.
He likes the X-Wing.
He likes the X-Wing. Of course, it's a rad ship.
And R2 and 3PO are his favorite characters.
Right.
Which
is correct.
Is awesome.
That is the right leaning. They are the best characters.
I don't interact with that many other children.
Yeah.
But like, what other kids choose R2 and 3PO as their favorites?
They were my favorites when I was kids.
Were they?
Yeah. I think they are the best developed characters in that first movie.
That is, yeah, you're not wrong.
They have a great dynamic. Their relationship is very clearly sketched out. One of them speaks no dialogue, and you always understand what he's beeping and chirping.
Yep.
Yeah. He's just rude as fuck.
I love it when he curses.
Oh, yeah. You know when he curses.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's the honk, honk, honk.
Yep. It's like a vacuum farting. So that is both my zert and my veg. Yeah. Star Wars. I am both very excited to share it with my child and also really, really desperately avoiding dumping all of my Star Wars baggage on him. That's the thing I've been super careful to be like, let's just watch these movies. It's just a movie. It's fine. And then when we had a technical problem when I switched from the despecialized to the whatever the fuck they're calling it, the version that's on streaming. I was just like, oh, there's a problem with the file. We'll just watch this one instead. He's like, okay. And then we went back and watched it the next night. We just watched all of the special edition Disney Plus version. And he was noticing all the bullshit that's all added to Mos Eisley, all the bullshit that's in the background.
Yep.
And he's like, whoa, I don't remember this. This is so cool. And I was like, yeah, it's
sure.
Great. Let's just keep going. That's fine. This is all dumb stuff for babies. But yeah, you are five, so yeah, it's okay.
He's five. Of course he's going to think it's cool.
But it all looks so bad. It does. It looks so bad.
But he also doesn't care.
He doesn't care. But CGI Jabba looks so bad.
I know.
And the CGI dinosaur thing that the Jawas are riding looks truly terrible.
Really bad.
Yeah. It was just like, when you look back on it, because the thing is that like all of this was happening in the late 90s, right? So like 96, 97 is when the special edition work was being done, right?
Yes.
So that means that George Lucas said, at long last, I'm going to, this is the legend that he tells, we're going to fix Star Wars and we're going to correct all of the bad effects that always drove me crazy. And we're going to get to include the stuff that I could never include because of the technological limitations of the time. So I'm going to wait until the infancy of a new visual effects technology. And I will use the visual effects from the darkest era of CGI, which is the mid to late 90s, the post Terminator 2, post Jurassic Park CGI boom, when everybody thought, oh, we can do whatever we want with this technology now, but no one had taken the time to figure out how to do any of it.
Yes, that's correct.
And so he has now marred his original movies with their supposedly inferior effects from the 70s and 80s.
With
now
inferior effects from the 90s.
The worst CGI.
Yep.
It's just so frustrating, George. It's just so frustrating.
Yeah.
Why can't he just admit that he was wrong? There's no way that he looks at any of that shit and is happy with it.
It got to be a special kind of deluded.
Yeah.
Is really I'm sure George. That in his head, in his, the fantasy world that he lives in.
It's fine.
It's perfect. Yeah. It's exactly what I meant to do.
Yep. I always wanted it to look like rubber bullshit. I always wanted Han Solo to laterally shift without blinking or changing his expression to magically dodge a laser blast so that he can then return fire.
Or for Han to step on Jabba's tail while they're having a conversation.
I will say they tweaked that again. And that does look a little bit better than it did in 97. And then they tweaked it again in 2004 for the DVD release.
Whatever.
And then I think there was another tweak for the 2011.
Your son has seen Star Wars.
He's seen a Star War. He's seen one.
He went and saw a Star War.
He liked it.
It was a good Star War.
He had a good time.
It's wonderful.
It was delightful.
He likes R2 and 3PO.
He immediately recognized that the opening fanfare was similar to the opening fanfare of 1978's Superman the movie, which is also scored by John Williams. So we're doing something right in this household.
I'm going to choose to fixate on these things and not on George Lucas being a
right. Well, I'm also fixating on the silver lining of that. It's still COVID and we're still being cautious. And so he doesn't need to go to stores and see that there's fucking Star Wars toys everywhere.
Right.
And so he can continue to just inherit my old Star Wars shit. What little of it that I like didn't get rid of.
Of mine too.
That's true. Yeah. You're going to fucking
with the poinks on it.
You're going to win Christmas. You son of a bitch. That's a good, he's going to like that.
I forgot. I also have, at that scale, the Jenner, Slave One.
What?
Which obviously can't happen yet.
Right, because he doesn't know.
But
he doesn't
it's know got the handle on that. The back of it, so you can fly it.
I remember
it.
That one. Yeah. That was cool.
It's a cool one.
That's a cool ship.
It really is.
Boba Fett's stupid, but that's a cool ship.
Boba Fett is cool.
Boba Fett is cool.
But like, the absurd like enthusiasm for Boba Fett makes no sense.
Well, Jamie, just you wait until, is it late this year? Or I think it's this year. I think it's December or maybe January.
Don't. You're going to say something that's going to make me upset, aren't you?
The Disney Plus season one of Boba Fett.
Fuck off.
Called The Book of Boba Fett.
Fuck all the way off. Because
they brought
him
back in Baby Mando season two.
All right. We're moving on. I'm done talking about this. This is an episode about The Matrix.
But
all
it
right?
is Temuera Morrison coming back to play Boba Fett, a character who he only played as a voiceover performance in the DVD re-releases of the Star Wars movies after he had played Jango Fett in all the clones.
Whatever. God damn it.
It seems like he's trying to consolidate power amongst all of the intergalactic crime in the vacancy created by the death of Jabba the Hutt.
See, this is...
That sounds kind of cool.
I said we're not going to talk about
but
it.
But that sounds kind of cool.
Sure. Or fucking... I know. Fucking whatever.
This is the other zerts with opening the floodgates of Star Wars in my house, is that now
the IP is fucking everywhere.
Well, it's everywhere, and now like I'm just thinking about Star Wars more, and I had been very happy not to do that for a very long time.
Yeah.